40. Greetings to all of our Voice of America listeners. I'm VOA's Andrew Palcheski in Washington, filling in for Sonny Young. Welcome to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Stand up! Stand up! Stand up! Stand up!
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
The Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports.
The Sunny Side of Sports show.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Stand up. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
Well, it's been said that all good things must come to an end, and that was certainly the case last night in the National Basketball Association as the Houston Rockets faced off against the visiting Los Angeles Lakers. Now, despite a whopping 51 points from Houston's James Harden, the best beard in basketball, Houston wasn't able to capture the victory, falling to the Lakers 122-116. And with that loss, Houston's 14-game winning streak comes to an end. For the Lakers, there's much to be happy about, not only because of the win and not only because they snapped that Houston streak, but because their rookie forward, Kyle Kuzma, notched a career-high 38 points and 7 three-pointers, including 6 threes in the first half. But even in the loss, there are some positive takeaways for Houston as well. By scoring 51 points, Harden set a Houston Rockets record, scoring at least 20 points in his last 30 games, besting the previous franchise record, a 29-game scoring streak set by the great Moses Malone in the 1981-1982 season. And although Houston's 14-game streak comes to an end, it's buoyed them to the best record in the NBA, 25 wins and just 5 losses on the season so far. Other top teams in action in the National Basketball Association last night? In the Western Conference, the Golden State Warriors continue to cultivate their own win streak, capturing their 10th victory in a row with a 97-84 win over the Memphis Grizzlies. And the San Antonio Spurs won a close contest over the Portland Trailblazers 93-91. In the NBA's Eastern Conference, the Boston Celtics, the best team in the East, lost a tight game to the Miami Heat, with a final score of 90-89. It marks the second time this season that the Heat have beaten the Celtics. Meanwhile, the Toronto Raptors bested the Charlotte Hornets 129-111 to give the Raptors their 4th win in a row. And the Cleveland Cavaliers, currently sitting at number 3 in the Eastern Conference, were off last night. They'll take on the Chicago Bulls tonight in Chicago. Well, it may still be 2017, but the year is rapidly coming to an end, and the 2018 Winter Olympic Games are rapidly approaching. And as we get closer and closer to the opening ceremonies on February 9th, organizers in the host city of Pyeongchang, South Korea, are feverishly working to make sure everything is ready. But as they continue to prepare, there are some lingering concerns about everything from the safety and accessibility of event venues to the simmering tensions between North and South Korea, to a lack of enthusiasm for the games among Koreans, and even a reported outbreak of bird flu. Our VOA colleague Jim Stevenson looked at some of those concerns, starting with worries that event tickets will go unsold.
The IOC's Olympic Games Executive Director, Christoph Duby, says ticket sales are improving, especially since the Olympic torch relay began in South Korea.
We discussed about the ticketing situation, which is improving. They were qualifying themselves the period after the arrival of the torch as the boom up. And it's true that we can see now a big difference in the ticket sales on a daily basis, which is really reassuring.
Even with the optimistic report, organizers say that about half of the 1.1 million tickets have been sold. Low numbers in recent months have been a source of alarm, with organizers deciding to enforce a plan to mobilize 17 local governments and schools to boost sales. George Haley, the director of the Center for International Industry Competitiveness and a professor of marketing and international business at the University of New Haven, says several factors, from North Korea to the weather, have combined to hurt ticket sales.
North Korea has signed a treaty not to cause problems during the Olympics, but nobody hears about that. All they hear is that the continuous belligerence between especially President Trump and the United States and North Korea itself. They've also had, in the region around the venues for the Olympics, an outbreak of bird flu, but that's also caused worry. Another problem they've had, they are counting on venues which haven't really been developed as tourist destinations, whether it's for winter sports or anything else. And there's been a shortage of hotel space, and even the weather has really hit them. In the main arena for the opening ceremonies, because of budgetary constraints, they didn't put a roof on it. And they recently had a music concert there. They had 7 cases of hypothermia they had to treat.
Andy Spaulding is a professor at the University of Richmond's Law School, specializing in international anti-corruption law and the lead author in the Olympic Anti-Corruption Report, Brazil and the Rio 2016 Games. He says the Korean political scandal last year and the role of several large companies such as Samsung have colored Koreans' views of the games.
There is some reason to think that the enthusiasm for the games in South Korea is not as high as the organizers would have liked or planned. And there are a number of reasons for this. One is that the games have certainly been tainted by corruption scandals. Samsung is a principal sponsor of the games, and its de facto leader has been convicted of bribery. Scandals in Korean business are commonplace historically. Cultural norms in South Korea are changing now, and tolerance for this kind of thing is going down significantly. So I think there is a more of a stigma attached to bribery now in South Korean culture than there was in past decades.
Ira Rosen is an assistant professor at Temple University's School of Sport, Tourism, and Hospitality Management. He says even with a new high-speed rail line in place, there is a shortage of internationally recognized hotel rooms, which makes overseas visitors reluctant to spend the money on traveling to the Olympics.
I think people are a little more leery traveling to areas that are a little off the beaten track, as it were, as, you know, the South Korean market is certainly for the European traveler, for the North American traveler. It's a pretty much unknown market. And again, I think people are leery about risking the kind of money that it takes to travel to an Olympics Games with that risk level in mind.
South Korea lacks a robust winter sports culture, and organizers say Koreans tend to buy tickets at the last minute for major events. Games organizers are also counting on ticket revenue to meet operating expenses for the games. But George Haley of the University of New Haven says the South Korean government will make sure all issues are handled because of its larger regional political goals.
They view their Winter Olympics as the beginning of a series of athletic events through which they hope to start promoting greater peace and amity between the Asian countries. Reducing tensions between the different countries. And to them, this is a very important undertaking.
Thank you to Jim Stevenson for that report. We'll continue to bring you the latest on the preparation for the 2018 Winter Olympic Games in Pyeongchang, South Korea, right here on the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Andrew Palcheski in Washington, filling in for Sunny Young, and this is the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music.
Wake up, dance this music.
Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on the Voice of America.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
The Voice of America.
Well, of all the sports predictions made at the end of last year, I don't think anyone could have predicted the year that we've seen in tennis. A year ago, Serena Williams tied the record for the most Grand Slam titles for any woman or man in the Open era, picking up her 22nd major title at Wimbledon. Meanwhile, two of the sport's top male players, Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal, were sidelined with injury. What a difference a year makes. 2017 saw Williams out for much of the year as she gave birth to her first child, and Federer and Nadal staged a comeback that no one could have imagined, with the two men splitting the year's Grand Slam titles, Federer winning at the Australian Open and at Wimbledon, and Nadal picking up his record 10th French Open championship, as well as the title at the US Open. So with all the craziness going on in tennis this year, I wanted to chat with Giddy Nathan, who covers tennis for the sports website Deadspin. And we touched on everything from the big names out with injury, or in Serena's case, pregnancy, to some of the surprising young players making their mark, to predictions for the year ahead. But we started with arguably the biggest story of the year, the Federer-Nadal resurgence. And I asked Giddy, how exactly did these two players, out of the game for much of 2016, manage to sweep the Grand Slams in 2017?
I think it's probably best explained by the fact that both those two players wisely took off a lot of time towards the end of 2016 to recover from their respective injuries, then returned to a field that had been left open by the new weakness of Andy Murray and Novak Djokovic, each of whom took the latter half of this season off to address their injuries. So I think given the fact that the Big Four have largely dominated men's tennis for the last generation, having two of those recover in full health and the other two sort of fall out of the tour in ailing health really opened the door for Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal, probably the two best players ever, to sweep the Grand Slams and win a lot of other stuff in between.
Yeah, and those injuries were very conspicuous. Certainly Andy Murray and Novak Djokovic, as you mentioned, but Stan Wawrinka, number three in the world in 2016. Milos Raonic was number four in the world at the end of 2016. Kei Nishikori was number five in the world. So really, the top five guys from 2016 yep. all out in 2017 for either the whole year or part of the year. Can any of those players make a comeback in 2018?
Yeah, I think I would be very surprised if Novak Djokovic and Andy Murray did not return in very strong form. Also looking forward to the return of Stan Wawrinka, who had what seemed to be a pretty serious knee surgery and was off his feet for 4 months while recovering from it. He was slated to return in an exhibition later this month, but we just got a report today that that's actually going to be pushed back. So hopefully he can be in good shape by the time the Australian Open comes around. But I really expect most of those players to come back very strong. I know Ken Nishikori is a pretty injury-prone player, but when he is healthy, he's one of the toughest players to beat on the tour.
And that gap that's been left from all of those injuries has allowed some surprising players to come to the forefront in 2017. You had Grigor Dimitrov winning the ATP Tour Finals. Alexander Zverev is just 20 years old, and he ends the year at number 4 in the world. Not to mention American Jack Sock winning the Paris Masters. Kevin Anderson of South Africa rising up back to number 14 after being plagued by injuries. Other than Federer, Nadal, and even Murray and Djokovic, if they come back in 2018, who do you see emerging or solidifying their success from 2017? And looking back at 2017, of all those guys, who had the best year other than Federer and Nadal?
I think most analysts feel pretty confident in Alexander Zverev eventually getting to world number one and probably winning a handful of slams as well. So in terms of having a breakout year, he had some pretty impressive runs, beating Novak Djokovic, beating Roger Federer, pushing Rafael Nadal to 5 sets. He hasn't quite proved that he has the stamina to win in the best of five format, but now he has Masters title under his belt. He seems poised to make that next step. And I think Grigor Dimitrov is another player who had been hailed as sort of a stylistic successor to Roger Federer and had a lot of the natural racket skills that Federer did, but never really backed that up in terms of on-court wins. And this season, a lot of this can be attributed to clearing of the way by having those top five players sit out with injury. But he was able to secure the biggest tournament win of his life, first in Cincinnati and then an even bigger one at the ATP Finals in London. So I was especially impressed by the performances of those two players. You also have Nick Kyrgios and Dominic Thiem, a clay court specialist who had very strong performances there, becoming the only man to beat Rafael Nadal on that surface this season. And Nick Kyrgios, obviously very volatile and hard to predict in his performance, but he had a few statement wins there as well over Novak Djokovic, a very close 3-set over eventually losing to Roger Federer, and a big win over Rafael Nadal as well.
Looking forward to 2018, of course, the first major tournament coming up will be the Australian Open in January. Any thoughts or predictions for that tournament? Of course, Roger Federer is the defending champion there. Can he defend his title, or will that be derailed by one of these other young players?
It will definitely be unusual to see some of the best players in the game at seedings that you might not be used to seeing them at, given that they're coming back from injury. But I do think Federer will have a great chance at repeating, especially if he's in as good a form as he was physically, as he was in all of the majors this year. He did show a few signs of back issues, you know, at the U.S. Open and eventually at London as well. But aside from that, he had a basically immaculate season. So assuming his body holds up, he'll be one of the top players in the game as well. Australian Open courts were kind to him, given that they played very fast, which suits his style of play.
Yeah, certainly. I think a lot of fans are hoping to see him go quite far and continue this record-setting run that he's on. On the women's side, we started the year with Serena Williams capturing her own record, the 23rd Grand Slam title of her career, giving her the most of any man or woman in the Open era. And then what does she do? She takes off for the rest of the year to have her first child. And that really opened the door for a lot of women. Yelena Ostapenko winning the French Open at just 20 years old. I believe it's her first tournament ever that she's won. Garbiñe Muguruza of Spain winning her second Grand Slam title at Wimbledon. And Sloane Stephens taking advantage of that All-American semifinal to win the U.S. Open. So very different from the men's side where Rafa and Roger dominated. You had four different women win the Grand Slam tournaments in 2017. And I'll ask you, out of those four women, who out of those do you think had the best year?
I would say Ostapenko, as you mentioned, is the most thrilling newcomer out of that bunch in that her victory wasn't really heralded in the same way that, you know, Sloane Stephens had a lot of buzz earlier in his career, came back from an injury, made a huge ascension in the rankings and won that U.S. Open, but she'd kind of been a known quantity before. And Garbiñe Muguruza has had fantastic runs at the Slams, won the final over Venus this year. I think I still feel going into the next year that it'll always be tough to bet against Serena Williams, you know, arguably the most dominant individual athlete ever. And you have to imagine that her recovery after childbirth will be just as impressive as the rest of the work that she's put into her career.
Yeah, and it does indeed look likely that she will be returning for the 2018 Australian Open in a bid to defend her title. Will we expect her to do exactly that and come back after being off for 8 or 9 months to have her child and defend her title and win the Australian Open?
There is a bit of confusion over whether she will end up playing the tournament. The tournament director has spoken in the affirmative. Serena Williams has been, as some tennis journalists have noted, has been booked for a speaking appearance that would take place during the semifinals of that tournament, not in Australia. So it's a little bit up in the air as to whether her recovery and everything will be at the point where she will play the tournament. But if her team decides that she is ready to play, I think she will have a typically strong run there. I also realize I haven't mentioned Venus Williams thus far, who had an incredible 2017 as well, 2 slam finals and a semifinal as well. But obviously of those two, Serena's the more continued in her dominance over that field.
Yeah, and I was going to ask about Venus. I'm glad you brought that up. Of course, she went to 2 Grand Slam finals in Australia and Wimbledon and the U.S. Open semifinal, and she did it all at the age of 37. When players have retired even at younger ages than that, she's still going strong. What explains this amazing year in 2017 that she's had, and can she keep it going for 2018?
So I think that in part could be attributed to the power vacuum that we've described on both the men's and women's tour this year. I don't imagine we'll see Venus Williams in 2 slam finals and a semifinal again next season, but given how well she played this season and assuming continued good health, I see no reason for her not to make strong runs, especially on her preferred surfaces of grass, where she's been such a strong presence at Wimbledon throughout her career, and she's really mastered those big serves, playing short points, closing to the net. I do think she could repeat and have a very strong performance there in London.
I'll ask you a similar question I asked about the men's side, but for the women's side, looking ahead to the first tournament, first big tournament, the Australian Open. Of course, if Serena does play, I think that she'll be one of the favorites, if not the favorite. But if she doesn't, who else might emerge and could become Australian Open champion 2018?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it'll be interesting to see after some of the turnover in the WTA over the last season, whether some of the more established players start to break through, like Simona Halep, for example, who ended the year at number one but did not make it to winning any of the slams this season. I still expect her to be a very strong contender this season. Muguruza as well, and Wozniacki rounding out the top three. Ostapenko has made a pretty surprising surge in the rankings, but I don't expect her to bound forward in her career quite yet. She's still a very young player. And Venus, again, we have to include in that mix as well. But it'll be a pretty surprising and hopefully very interesting Australian Open on the women's side. There's still a huge question mark over Serena Williams. And after this very even and well-distributed 2017 season, it will be interesting to see who breaks through.
Absolutely. And that's a good place to close with our final question. I'll have you look into the crystal ball, and on the men's and women's side, one prediction for each for 2018 in tennis.
Let's say this. I think Nick Kyrgios will win a Masters tournament. He may do a whole lot of losing as well, but I do think he'll string together enough good wins on a fast surface to do that. And I think that Serena Williams will at least make a slam final by the summer, end of the summer.
I think it's safe to say that after this year, anything is possible in tennis in 2018. My thanks to Giddy Nathan, tennis writer for the sports website Deadspin. And finally, today, the saga of the Ball family continues. LeVar Ball, a man who's known as much for his basketball-playing sons as his big claims, says he's launching a new league, the Junior Basketball Association. LeVar says it's designed for players like his sons LiAngelo and LaMelo who don't want to play college basketball but want to play professionally right out of high school. Now, there's a lot of debate about whether or not this will work and the potential impact on college basketball. However the league turns out, I think one thing's for certain. Everyone's going to be talking about it, and I'd venture to guess that's exactly what LeVar Ball wants. And that wraps up the December 21st edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to Voice of America producer Bill Werkinger, VOA engineer Dan Crafton, and thank all of you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Andrew Palcheski in Washington, and that's the sunny side of sports.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In Syria and Iraq, ISIS will soon be history. But even as it struggles to stay alive and relevant, it is critical that it not be allowed to regroup and flourish elsewhere. Terrorist groups with safe haven are able to export their violence around the world, striking our homeland and those of our closest allies. We saw Al-Qaeda do this from Afghanistan in the 1990s through 9/11. More recently, we saw ISIS do the same from Iraq and Syria, said Ambassador at Large and Coordinator for Counterterrorism Nathan Sales before a Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee recently. For that reason, the United States is working with partners in North Africa in order to deny terrorists the ability to operate in the continent's vast spaces where government reach is lacking. To mitigate the threat posed by terrorist groups in North Africa, we are helping fragile states build capacity, as well as leveraging highly capable states' counterterrorism expertise. We want to develop our African partners' counterterrorism capabilities to a point where they need not rely on assistance from the United States to defend themselves, said Ambassador Sales. The United States works with its partner states to improve their ability to investigate, prosecute, and adjudicate terrorism crimes. To stop terrorist travel, we are focusing on improving border security through information sharing at international borders, particularly with regard to known and suspected terrorists. Our efforts to prevent radicalization and recruitment of individuals into terrorist groups include delegitimizing the violent ideology they espouse. Countering radicalization in a way that is tailored to each North African country is another critical component of a comprehensive approach to counterterrorism, said Ambassador Sales. We undertake these efforts in cooperation with European allies, other key partners, and multilateral institutions to amplify their impact. The United States uses a range of tools and resources and works closely with the governments of North Africa and other partners to comprehensively address terrorism, said Ambassador Sales. Our training and resources are directly assisting partners to disrupt terrorist operations, prosecute terrorist suspects, and protect borders.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, Africa. This is James Brotte, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.
Hi, this is Lori London. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts.
every hour on the top of each hour 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.